Robin Young, it's here and now. After a nail-biter of an election, overnight analysis, and hours of waiting, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry has telephoned President George Bush and conceded defeat in the race for the White House. About an hour ago, Kerry said, "Congratulations, Mr. President," in a conversation that lasted fewer than 5 minutes. Kerry is expected to make a statement from Boston in about an hour. And joining us on the line from Boston's Faneuil Hall is Here and Now's Athena Desai. Athena, what's expected to happen there?
Well, right now, press and supporters or the general public are just lining up outside Faneuil Hall to see Senator Kerry speak. Apparently, the campaign is trying to accommodate all of us in the space inside Faneuil Hall, and I suppose Kerry will go into the concession at greater length.
And, of course, Faneuil Hall is a small historic building in Boston, just a couple blocks from the Senator's Louis Burke Square home on Beacon Hill. Do we know what else Senator Kerry said in his phone call to the president?
There are other things being reported on the wires, that the country is very divided and that, you know, something will need to be done with that no matter who the leader is. Some unnamed Democratic sources have said that Bush called Kerry a tough and honorable opponent. And more than that, I'm not sure.
Yeah. What are the Kerry aides saying ahead of his expected speech again in about an hour about how they reached their decision, because we were all poised for an Ohio recount?
Actually, the aides around here seem to be concerned with logistics. They're not really making a whole lot of statements to the press. I think they've tried to keep a tight lid on it this morning. I was also waiting outside of Senator Kerry's home in Louisburg Square in Boston, and it seems that they're trying to leave this up to Senator Kerry. That I think enough has been reported that the final word should probably come from the senator himself.
Okay, and we await that. Athena Desai, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now's Athena Desai in Boston's Faneuil Hall awaiting John Kerry's concession speech. As we said, it's expected in about an hour. And we turn now to Here and Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff. She's been covering the Bush campaign from Washington. Monica, was this a surprise to people there, by the way?
Well, it wasn't a surprise that the president has won, because all night they heard from their people at the Reagan building that the president is winning re-election, but they were just miffed at why he didn't come over from the White House and accept victory. So I think a lot of them are probably just waking up and hearing this news and putting on their credential and heading back to the Reagan building to get in line and get ready to hear his victory speech at 3 o'clock.
I know you're going to be doing the same, and I guess I meant the surprise that Kerry was conceding, because, as we said, there were words this morning about Kerry seeing the light today, perhaps. So was there a surprise that Kerry's conceding?
Well, there's clearly a lot of pressure put on Kerry from the Bush campaign, saying that they wanted to give him the respect to basically give it up. They didn't say that last night in those exact words, but, you know, this morning it was all talking about Senator Kerry needs to examine these results in the light of day. So I don't think there's much surprise, because the Bush campaign just keeps putting those figures out there that the president has won a convincing reelection with 286 electoral votes, they say, and won by a margin of more than 3.5 million popular votes. This is just, you know, an absolute majority. So it's, you know, they've been putting the pressure on him through the media for sure. So I don't think they're surprised that he's finally listened and conceding.
In fact, isn't President Bush's camp saying that he's won with more votes than any American president?
That's right. That's right. And they're sort of crowing about that right now. And I'm sure they will be all day. And I'm sure we'll hear about this was not a squeaker like in 2000. And this really could change the mandate for the president and how his domestic and foreign policies are implemented, because he has won such a more commanding victory, a very commanding victory, and definitely no waiting around for re-vote counts in Florida like the last election, nor even looking at provisional ballots in Ohio, which is what many people went to bed last night thinking would happen.
Well, in fact, Monica, you were covering this story last night. People did drop out at different hours. Some of us stayed through the whole thing. But since you were there following the Bush campaign, what was the mood as, you know, it went from yesterday afternoon through today? I mean, it must have just changed drastically.
It did. It went up and down and up and down. At first, it was a little down. The exit polls were showing that Senator Kerry was doing very well. Then around midnight, Florida came in for Bush. things started looking strong for them in Ohio, and you got the sense that any minute the president was going to hop in his motorcade from the White House and speed over to the Reagan building and speak to his supporters. And it just never materialized. And by 5:40 in the morning, what his handful of Republican supporters got, the ones who were still awake and at the building, was Chief of Staff Andy Card saying, "We've won." But they want to give Senator Kerry a little time to acknowledge it.
And what, by the way, what did they say? We're going to talk more in a moment about this, but what did they say, the Bush camp, about those early exit polls which showed John Kerry with the lead?
Well, from early on in the evening, the Republican strategists I spoke to said they don't trust him anyway, that it doesn't surprise them that they were wrong, in 2000, and that according to their numbers that they were looking at in rural areas in the country, as well as numbers with areas with heavy Republican registration, their numbers were going through the roof. Mm-hmm. So they were looking specifically at areas where they underperformed in 2000, and all of their exit polling was showing that the president was going to be clearly reelected. Mm-hmm. So I was hearing that all evening, even though it seemed to take a while for the real numbers to catch up with those predictions.
Yeah. Monica Brady.
And by the way,
go ahead.
Well, about the division, you know, I just wanted to note that, you know, earlier in the evening, Karen Hughes, a senior advisor to the president, said that, yes, she believed the president was going to win at this point. She said that the president would be a president for all Americans, even those who didn't vote for him. So I think we're going to hear a lot more of that in his victory speech this afternoon, that he realizes the division that this country is facing with this election, and he's ready to, you know, to address it.
We'll have more on that and the cultural divide that people are talking about more today than in the past, also on the program. Monica Brady-Meyerhoff speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Monica, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we turn now to Beltway veteran Richard Wolff. He's a political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He's been following all of this in Boston, awaiting John Kerry's concession speech at the moment. Richard, thanks so much for joining us. And what happened? I mean, we know that the numbers were overwhelming. Monica was talking about the pressure coming from Washington on John Kerry. But some of us were convinced that there was going to be this reevaluation of the ballots. So what happened?
Well, what happened was that they counted the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, there's been an intensive process for them to look at the margin of Bush's counted victory and compare it with the numbers of provisional ballots as they came through. And they wanted to see the facts first and foremost. It wasn't a sort of, we have to fight and fight on. It was very much more sober, much more detailed assessment of what was going on in Ohio.
Okay, and we're going to ask our listeners, by the way, to bear with your cell phone, Richard, because everybody's scrambling to get in position as the news is breaking, so please bear with us. But what do you think, Richard, was the breakdown of the voters?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Yes, I can. Well, actually, I'll let you know that the Los Angeles Times broke down the voters this way. They say Republicans mobilized a massive coalition of two-parent families, rural voters, gun owners, people who attend church. Senator Kerry did best with urban voters, singles. His supporters didn't own guns or attend church regularly on average. Is that how you saw the breakdown?
Yeah, you know, the really critical numbers here were the huge surprise of the number of people who cited moral values as the most important factor in the election. Those are the kinds of voters that clearly John Kerry didn't do well with, and that's the story of this election.
Right. A Bush campaign mastermind, Karl Rove, said that 4 years ago, 4 million evangelicals didn't vote in 2000, and that he was going to get out that vote this time around. It seems as if he succeeded.
He has, and he's really, I think, changed American politics in that way, showing that there is a block of voters that the Republicans have successfully energized and mobilized. I expect we'll see that time again in the next election cycles.
And we are going to be talking much more about that, in fact, with some voters who made their decision based on their moral and their values. But what are you feeling now? I mean, as you feel this shift, if we could call it that, in the day, what are you feeling from each of the camps?
Well, you know, this has been a roller coaster for the Kerry folks in particular, who I spent a lot of time with. You know, one thing we all made the mistake of was to believe those exit polls as they came out yesterday. And certainly the mood among the Kerry people when those exit numbers came out was overjoyed and ebullient. We all, the media and the political campaigners, and that includes the Bush campaign, because they were really extremely down by mid-afternoon yesterday. We all believed the exit polls and the lesson 2000, which was those things couldn't be trusted.
Right. And you were here in Boston. Tell listeners across the country what was happening here in Boston.
You know, the mood was very excited and overjoyed in Kerry's various hotels where his supporters were gathering. You know, as the evening wore on, the oxygen just got sucked out of the thing.
People
started to see those results coming in, and it was a slow, gradual dawning that the exit polls were very, very badly wrong.
There were thousands of people who were gathered in downtown Boston. It was quite an event. And then, as you said, over the course of the evening, things changed. And what were some of the moments when you, as a reporter, realized this is not what we thought? I'm thinking of Virginia.
Virginia was a big thing, yeah. When you saw Kerry advisors saying, we're going to have a big surprise in Virginia, it wasn't the surprise they thought it would be. They thought it would be an upset victory, and in fact it turned out that it wasn't even close. That was really the first warning sign that the exit polls were badly, badly wrong.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised by anything else? It seemed as if things went as they did in 2000 with only a few exceptions.
Yeah, I was surprised that the Democratic ground game didn't work. They spent something like $200 million on that huge amount of money raised. And
the Get Out the Vote movement.
The Get Out the Vote operation, the new voters, everything they had based the strategy on for the ground game really failed. And there's going to be an awful lot of post-mortem there as to how that money was wasted and what went wrong.
In fact, we're hearing that there was a lot of talk about the new young voters who don't show up in any kind of polling previous to the election because they use mostly cell phones. They're not listed, and so they don't get called. And we were hearing this morning that, in fact, some of those voters, or a lot of those voters, sure, they came out, they turned out, they voted, but they voted for Bush, which was not expected.
Yeah, absolutely. Although clearly those weren't the people that the Democrats hoped they were turning out. You know, the story here is that both sides believed that they had a base to energize a large group of people who were no shows last time around. But you know, to be honest, if some of the Democrats showed up, it just wasn't in enough numbers. The Republicans managed to get those no shows out there. And they did it around those issues of moral values. The war in Iraq came in something like fourth in terms of what people thought was the priority. And given that Iraq was the dominant theme for the Kerry campaign over the last month or so, that obviously didn't favor John Kerry.
We understand that the security moms are, even as we speak, being relabeled the morality moms. I tell you what, we're going to talk more about what is being called the culture divide, more about those ballot questions, what won, what didn't, the House and Senate races, with Richard Wolff. He's political correspondent for Newsweek magazine, one of many reporters waiting for John Kerry's concession speech. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Here and Now More when we come back. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking with Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He's in Boston awaiting John Kerry's concession speech. Richard, hello again.
Hello.
And we're joined as well by Joe Klein, senior writer at Time magazine. He's in New York. Joe, thanks so much for giving us some time. And your thoughts first on John Kerry's concession. Are you surprised?
No, I think that it was, that the handwriting was on the wall very, you know, as early as midnight last night. He's a clear-cut loser in this, and so I think it's definitely the right thing to do and the right time to do it.
Is he a clear-cut loser, though? I was reading in some articles today that this is the guy who was down. Well, you were with him in Iowa, down what, 30 points? Your overall impression of what's happened?
He lost by 3.5 million votes.
Mm-hmm.
He's a loser.
Okay.
I think that there are a couple of overriding things here. Karl Rove has been insisting since 2000 that there were 4 million evangelical votes that he didn't get in that election, in part because of the drunk driving incident that came up just before the election that year. He got them this time. He won by 3.5 million votes, and it seems to me, looking over the returns, a lot of those votes came from the Democratic support collapsing in rural areas and in middle America.
Well, and just one more thought from you, Joe, before we go back to Richard. President Bush went into this election with a less than 50% favorability rating, a war that's highly criticized and most say poorly run, and a bad economy. So,
that speaks to, A, the incompetence of the Democratic campaign, and B, the scurrilousness of the Republican campaign. First of all, President Bush's rating in all the polls was hovering around 50%, high 40s, low 50s, margin of error, and so it shouldn't be a surprise that he won this election by 51-48. On the war front, John Kerry, when he first got into this campaign in the summer of 2002, was very clear in the fact that a case was going to have to be made against the president in terms of national security and foreign policy. And then he stumbled, and he stumbled again, and he stumbled again. He voted in favor of the war and against the $87 billion. He listened to his advisors who said that you should not criticize the president on the war, that you should emphasize domestic issues. That was another wrong step. So even though this war is pretty disastrous and the economy is kind of iffy, although not quite so bad as Democrats would make it sound, Kerry was unable to take advantage of the president's failings.
And do you agree with Richard, who we're going to get back to in a second, but do you agree with Richard Wolff and others who say that that wasn't even the issue for a lot of people anyway? It was this idea of moral values.
Well, I think that that's a combination of things. And we have to get a much clearer notion of what moral values means to people. I mean, to a lot of people, a moral value might have been the fact that the president took a strong, unyielding, unnuanced stand on terrorism. He may have just seemed stronger and a more estimable person than John Kerry, to the majority of people. And that is largely attributable to an unprecedented negative campaign in terms of level of advertising and the president's own involvement of it that the Republicans ran.
Richard Wolff over at Newsweek magazine, actually on the phone here in Boston. But what happens now? I mean, looking ahead, will George Bush get everything he wants out of Capitol Hill? I mean, how did you see the rest of the election unfolding?
The rest of the new administration, I don't think there's any question that this will be an emboldened president. I mean, there'll be lots of talk today about reuniting the country, but this is a certain mandate. It will be taken as a mandate for Bush to pursue a whole range of things, whether it's privatization of Social Security, which he sees as a historic job. Remember, this is a president who sees very clearly his position in terms of his place in history. Mm-hmm. And I think you'll see emboldened hawks, the people who have been struggling to maintain their credibility and position because of Iraq, will be being reinvigorated, whether it comes to North Korea or Iran. So I think you're going to see a more vigorous administration on domestic and foreign agenda.
Joe Klein, who stays, who goes?
Well, it's hard to say. You got to figure that Colin Powell goes. Big test is going to be whether Donald Rumsfeld goes. I mean, a great many of the really devastating things that happened to this administration and to our country, more to the point, happened on his watch at the Pentagon. I disagree with Richard on a couple of things. First of all, there are the limitations of reality. No matter how empowered the president may feel or the hawks may feel, we don't have enough troops to pursue the policies we seem to be pursuing around the world, and we don't have enough money to do things like social security privatization at home. Mm-hmm. I'm told by a number of generals that come next spring, our rotation problems in the field in Iraq are going to be such that we will not be able to field more than three divisions, which is about 54,000 troops plus backups. Mm-hmm. You figure about 70,000 or 80,000 on the ground in Iraq without putting a serious and perhaps a breaking stress on the force.
Well, and we got less than a minute left. I want to touch one other thing. Richard Wolff, in less than a minute, will Justice Rehnquist feel free, perhaps, to retire now? He's ailing. And any predictions for Roe versus Wade?
Yes, he will feel free. I think a number of them, you'll see big changes on the Supreme Court, absolutely. Roe v. Wade, beyond my pay grade, I'm afraid. But you'll see a number of challenges. This will, again, the time for the base to feel emboldened.
Joe Klein, any thoughts? Oh, just a few seconds, but any thoughts on Roe v. Wade? Or, you know, huge statements by this new administration.
You know, it's really quite early to tell about something like Roe v. Wade. We have to see what kind of Supreme Court nominees the president will put up. You know, the Democrats still have the ability to filibuster this if it comes in too strong. But I would suggest that the Democratic Party is really going to have to reevaluate its positions on moral issues like gay marriage and abortion. That not to say that they're going to have to abandon, you know, their support for the right to choose, but I think that they may have to rein it in, you know, some, and concede late-term abortion and other things to the Republicans.
We're going to take a closer look at those issues and the cultural divide that they sit in. But in the meantime, thank you both. Joe Klein, senior writer at Time Magazine, Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek. Thank you both. And stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Capitol Hill is at least symbolically awash in red today as Republicans increase their majority in the House and Senate, picking up at least two seats in the House, three in the Senate. The biggest upset for the Democrats, the defeat of Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle of South Dakota, who lost his bid for a fourth term.
Thank you all. Thank you all for that incredible welcome and your warm reception, your friendship. Earlier today, I called John Thune to congratulate him, and he not only has won a Senate seat, but he's now been given a tremendous amount of trust and responsibility, and I wish him well. I also called earlier our Congresswoman again, Stephanie Herseth, and congratulated her on her outstanding victory. South Dakota is going to be served so well by that wonderful new young leader. I have a profound respect for the people of our state, and I respect their decision. I am grateful for the extraordinary opportunity that they have given me these many years. I've had the opportunity to serve our state as a member of the House of Representatives, as a member of the United States Senate, as Minority Leader of the United States Senate, and Majority Leader of the United States Senate.
Well, for a closer look at Daschle's defeat and the new makeup of the Senate and House, we turn to Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Andrea, everybody's half asleep today after last night's returns. Let's first turn to that South Dakota race, a battle fought with a barrage of attack ads and spending that broke all records in a Senate race. How severe a blow for the Democrats?
Pretty severe. You know, Robin, I just want to mention that I'm standing at the National Republican Victory Monument at the Ronald Reagan Center on Capitol Hill, which commemorates the Republicans taking over the House in 1994, 10 years ago. I think it's pretty fitting. I'm waiting for a press conference with the Senate, Senator George Allen. And I just got back from another press conference with Tom Reynolds in the House, a Republican, and they're pretty happy up here today. In the Daschle race, I think it was a matter of people felt that he had lost touch with South Dakotans, that he was more interested in the National Democratic Party and their agenda. Thune made a big deal about Daschle's wife, Linda, who is a lobbyist here, and was lobbying for drug companies. That didn't go over well. And don't forget that Thune almost won a couple of years ago over Tim Johnson by less than 600 votes. So it's not completely a surprise, but it is a big blow to the Democrats. You know, I believe the last time a leader was defeated was in 1952.
And Senate Minority Whip Harry Reid of Nevada is said to be announcing his run for minority leader. Is that the only name that surfaced?
Oh, no, I think you'll see Chris Dodd of Connecticut getting in that race, and maybe even Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Dick Durbin from Illinois is another person who might give it a try.
There were two victories for the Democrats in the Senate. Barack Obama easily defeated Alan Keyes for that Illinois seat. Ken Salazar won in Colorado. He defeated Republican Peter Kors of the beer magnate family. How big a victory for the Democrats?
Well, I think they're very happy about those two races, but they've got to be disappointed about all the other races that they thought they might have had a chance. Just within the last couple of hours, Betty Castor in Florida conceded in a very close race in Florida to Mel Martinez. They were beaten really badly in Oklahoma, where Tom Coburn, the Republican, beat out Brad Carson, a very young 37-year-old congressman there that they had pinned a lot of hopes on. You know, this wasn't a very good day for them. I mean, in Louisiana, David Vitter won a majority, which means there was no runoff for the two Democrats he was going up against. Democrats were pinning their hopes that maybe there'd be a December 4th runoff that they could pull out, but he just swept them away.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, just tell us, overall, what's the general makeup of the House and Senate? I mean, it would seem to be, but is it, for instance, more conservative than it was yesterday, you know, in the future?
Well, I tell you that the Senate is definitely much more conservative. Jim DeMint in South Carolina, who won yesterday, very conservative. I think Tom Coburn is one of the most conservative members coming up there. And I think over in the House, it's interesting that there were some Republican moderates in Connecticut, Chris Shays, Rob Simmons, two of the most vulnerable, endangered Republicans, both pulled it out last night. But I think generally speaking, this is a huge victory for Tom DeLay, the majority leader, who's very conservative. And I think just like President Bush played to the conservative Republican base, I think that worked for the Congress.
And in fact, let's stay with Tom DeLay for a minute, House Majority Leader from Texas. He was, some would say successful in redistricting efforts in Texas. Four Democratic representatives lost their seats there, even though Tom DeLay had come under some criticism in the last few months for his politicking. How does this play out for Republicans?
You know, they would not have had such a good day if Texas was not redistricted. I mean, plain and simple, they got four seats there because the lines were redrawn, basically. And Tom DeLay was instrumental. He was the person who did that. I asked Tom Reynolds, the chairman of the House Republican Campaign Committee, if DeLay was going to stay in his leadership role, given the fact that there are questions, ethical questions. I mean, he could still be indicted down in Texas. And he said, no, you know, he's been a great mentor. He's been instrumental. He's raised a massive amount of money. And I think you're going to see Republicans get right behind him. And there's not going to be any question about that.
Andrea, I'm taking a quick look at all the ballot initiatives across the country. 11 states voted to ban gay marriage. California did okay some stem cell research in their initiative there. But overall, it seems as if the ballot questions also went more closely aligned to President Bush's agenda. What does this mean for President Bush overall as far as the rest of his agenda? I'm thinking tax cuts, Social Security overhaul.
Well, I have to say, looking at the exit polls last night, you know, we all thought was going to be Iraq or terrorism or the economy. And most people, Republicans, went in the ballot box and we're interested in moral issues, you know, the gay marriage, abortion, guns, I think none of us really predicted that. So I think we're going to see more of that. I'm not sure about tax cuts. I mean, the deficit is huge, getting bigger. I don't think we're getting out of Iraq anytime soon. So that might be a hard sell. But, this does seem to be a mandate. The president got, I think 3 million votes. It was a lot wider margin than he got last time. So I think that you will see something going on in Social Security. I think we'll see more of the agenda. And it's just, it's going to depend. You know, in the Senate now, the Republicans have 55. That's still not enough to cut off a filibuster, which they need 60. But there are some moderate Democrats who maybe they can get to their side, so it will be easier for them. I think one thing you're going to see, obviously, especially with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court being ill with thyroid cancer, is we're going to see some changes in the Supreme Court, and it's going to be very interesting to see how far the president wants to go in terms of a litmus test or getting anti-abortion people up there. Will the Democrats, you know, try to block that?
And as we're going to hear, there are a lot of voters who voted for George Bush who want him to put his personal opinions on issues like abortion to policy. Andrea
right.
Stone, thanks so much. Andrea, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Well, as we've been saying, early in the afternoon yesterday, exit polls seemed to suggest a Kerry victory, so much so that some of the pundits started talking about what the Bush campaign had done wrong, as if he'd already lost the election. Today, of course, we see a very different situation. Pollsters from the Kerry campaign and the GOP had a press conference call today to talk about the polling. Here now is Bob Oakes listened in, and he has more from that conference. Bob, what did they say?
Well, basically, they said it's safe to predict that in the immediate future, exit polling is going to sit under a microscope. The two pollsters were Republican Frank Luntz and Democratic pollster Mark Milman. They talked with reporters, and Luntz especially was highly critical of the early exit polling yesterday, which initially indicated the race was probably swinging John Kerry's way.
The exit polling yesterday was absolutely atrocious. It got wrong. State after state after state. Not only did it get it wrong narrowly or get it wrong by the projection, but it got it wrong by percentages that were absolutely unprecedented. And it wasn't a single mistake. It was a mistake that happened all across the country.
And Bob, did Frank Luntz, the Republican, did he say what the mistake was? I mean, what went wrong?
Well, they're going to have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out what went wrong. Luntz pointed out it might have been the modeling or the wrong people called and or the wrong questions being asked. But he took a very hard line, saying exit polling's usability and quality is called into question for the future. Melman was somewhat less hard line. All the numbers need to be digested before you can figure out what went wrong, he says. But he also said something that will catch the ear of critics, that exit polls released on Election Day are polls that are not completely finished and certainly not fully analyzed, raising this rather obvious but important question. If that's so, then why release the numbers or why do them at all?
All right. Well, given the fact that they're both saying that, you know, the exit polls were all wrong, what are they saying about the actual election results? And by the way, why shouldn't we trust their analysis? But what are they saying?
Well, Melman's explanation is pretty simple and straightforward, at least in the early going here. He says the election turned on the culture issue. According to him, it's faith that mattered.
The culture war really defines the fundamental divisions in this country. The single question that gives you the greatest division on the vote these days is how often you attend church or synagogue. People who go regularly vote overwhelmingly Republican. People who never show their face tend to vote Democrat.
It's Melman's view that class-based politics, the politics that dominated America since the New Deal, the rich versus the poor, has now been replaced by culture-based politics. It's faith that matters. And we certainly heard President Bush touch on the faith theme, embracing God on the campaign trail and God in the White House repeatedly over the course of the campaign.
We're going to talk more about the politics of culture and faith in just a few minutes. But any final observations from you, Bob, from the pollsters?
Well, just one other from the Democrat, Melman. He observed that many people made the decision at the ballot box based on what he called personal image. That is, voters asking themselves at that crucial moment before they pull the lever or punch out the Chad, would that person, would the candidate make decisions the way that I would? And we all know that John Kerry was criticized repeatedly during the campaign for sometimes projecting this image of being too thoughtful and too ponderous during the campaign, while Bush was lauded for that gut-level decision-making that he's famous for, that instinctual decision-making that basically said, trust me. And we'll hear more about this as the days go on.
And we'll hear more about that sense of belief and morals. We'll hear from a listener who says that John Kerry might have had personal morals, but he wasn't willing to make them policy, and that mattered to a lot of voters, apparently. Bob Oakes, thanks so much.
Surely.
Here now is Bob Oakes on yesterday's faulty exit polling. And this note, foreign leaders are weighing in on the U.S. election. In Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin, meeting with Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, said they both welcomed the Bush victory. Putin said the president's re-election would reinforce America's solidarity with the global fight on terrorism. And before it was clear that the president had won, France's foreign minister said that no matter who wins, the election will lead to a renewal of transatlantic ties. But one former French foreign minister said Mr. Bush's victory would leave the world with a hangover. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Early on in the 2004 campaign, Republican strategist Karl Rove pledged to mobilize the 4 million evangelicals who stayed home in the 2000 elections. Well, as we've heard analysts say, he succeeded. He also captured a huge block of Americans who are not evangelical, but are passionate about their values and beliefs regarding same-sex marriage, abortion, personal responsibility. And they want their president to be equally passionate. Here and now, listener Todd Erickson of Miami told us, John Kerry has morals, but is unwilling to impose them on policy.
I want a leader who recognizes that there is right and there is wrong. I want a leader who recognizes that that evil and good exist. Many people thought George Bush's evangelicalism, if that's even a word, is wrong because it brings religion into government. Individuals like myself and my wife, we don't see that. We think it brings moral values into government, and that's really what we want from our leadership.
How do you feel about people like John Kerry and his followers? Do you feel, is there some sort of, you know, like, as if you're not taking taken seriously? I mean,
I don't know if not being taken seriously is the right phrase, but you're exactly right in that there is a sense that individuals like myself don't feel properly respected for having the moral beliefs that we do, feel almost condescended to, like we're cave people, and that somehow our views of the world are archaic and no longer valid. It's insulting, frankly, and I think that the underlying smoldering passion that few people recognized in polls, you know, was recognized last night and today.
Our listener, Todd Erickson, well, how big is the culture divide? And did Democrats ignore listeners like Todd at their peril? Joining us is Cheryl Jakes of the Human Rights Campaign in Washington, D.C. They're a gay and lesbian political organization. Cheryl, a lot of people who voted for Bush are waking up today saying Democrats just don't get it.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
Good. How are you?
You know, here's what I think we're getting is an extraordinarily mixed message. The same people who supposedly voted for President Bush on so-called moral issues, the same people who voted against ballot initiatives, voted for ballot initiatives to ban gay marriage, are also telling us over 61% of those who voted support legal recognition of same-sex couples, civil unions, domestic partnership benefits, the right to visit one another at a hospital emergency room and be legally connected to your children. They support those things. So what I think really happened here is, at least with regard to the question of gay rights, is the question got called too early. The quiz was given to the students before they knew the information.
Well, is that it, Cheryl, or is it, as many are saying, that people like Todd say there is good and evil, John Kerry and many Democrats see a gray area and are unwilling to be so, you know, they're more willing to split hairs on these issues, and that just didn't play in this election.
Well, you know, and I think that the president, frankly, did a better job of turning this into you're with good or you're against evil, mm-hmm. and the gray got lost. Again, you can't have 61% of these voters supporting legal recognition of same-sex couples and also deciding that that's immoral. Clearly, there is a level at which people understand basic fairness and abhor discrimination, and it's still within their moral compass.
Yeah.
And defining that and getting there and having that conversation didn't happen.
Yeah. Cheryl, just a few seconds left. How are you feeling going into these next 4 years?
You know, today is a bleak day and a hard feeling in the sense that a president who was willing to use gays and lesbians as a wedge issue to divide this country has now been reelected. Mm-hmm. I would hope, and I'm always an eternal optimist for our country, that the president would immediately look at a very tight election, look at a very divided country, and say, how do I unite this country?
Do you think, pitting people against each other? Do you think that he will approve a constitutional amendment that would ban, or do you think the constitutional amendment proposed to ban same-sex marriages will be picked up again and passed?
I think that there are those who want to push it, like Senator Rick Santorum and Congressman Tom DeLay. I do think we will continue to defeat it, and I hope the president will start to think about his legacy and start to think about the fact that he does not want to be known as the president who wrote discrimination into the United States Constitution.
Cheryl Jakes is with the Human Rights Campaign. Cheryl, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
We turn now to Pat Truman. He's with the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C., a group that identifies itself as defending family, faith, and freedom. Pat, did those three things win?
Well, certainly the people who are value voters voting on morality and traditional morality won. And I just point out, Robin, what I just heard from Cheryl Jakes. This is what's wrong with the Democratic Party. They've never gotten an understanding of where the public stands on the issue of marriage. Everything is put in terms of, oh, discrimination and et cetera with respect to the homosexuals, when in fact what the way the American public sees the issue is an attack on marriage, an attack on values. So it isn't an attack on homosexuals in their perspective. It's an attack on marriage and values. That's why they went to the polls. And this is why getting John Kerry to lead the charge for the Democrats was the wrong issue. He came out of the one state where a court had legalized homosexual marriage. Had that not happened, I think John Kerry might have won.
Well, but Pat, I want to ask you, you're a man of faith. You've been on our program before. There are a lot of people, Democrats, waking up today saying, wait a minute, I defend family, faith, and freedom. I just maybe don't believe that it should be legislated. I mean, is it fair for what seems to have happened to have happened, which is a co-opting of the words morality and faith and belief and the sense that only one side has them?
No, it may not be fair, but it's the perceptions that we're dealing with. Now, you take John Kerry, who was saying over and over again, I was an altar boy, I'm a Catholic, I can't impose my values. Well, wait a minute. He took time off the campaign trail when he hardly voted at all this year to come back and vote down a bill that would have prohibited partial birth abortion. He voted against the Defense of Marriage Act. He has no problems voting what he really believes, and then he goes off and tells the public that he can't impose his so-called Catholic values. The public doesn't understand that. What you have now is a very well-educated voter. It's exactly the opposite of what Cheryl Jakes said in terms of the public understanding the homosexual issue. The public understands it very well, because if you watch evening television, it's in your face. If you see what's happening in the courts, it's in your face, etc. And they're saying, wait a minute. Marriage is a bedrock issue.
Pat, we've got about 1 minute, and I just want you to your comments on this. Your side won, but was it at a cost? The country's incredibly divided.
Well, at a cost of what? I mean, we're preserving important values here, marriage. And when you look at the initiatives on marriage in the states, 62% in Ohio, 75% in Kentucky, 59% in Michigan.
But I would say to you, Pat, I would say to you, and again, we just have a few seconds. You and I are going to talk again, and we love having you on the program. But I would say, at a cost of national unity.
Do you mean to say that if we had voted with the other side on this, that we'd have national unity?
Mm-hmm.
No, of course we've got to divide along these moral issues. We've got to divide on the war and so many other issues. But I think now the important thing for the for the left in this country is to say, wait a minute, I think we've overstepped our bounds. People are fairly tolerant of homosexuals. I know I teach my kids to be, but when they want to say, well, no, a marriage is whatever we want it to be, and in this case, we want it to be two homosexuals or, you know, a father and a daughter, whatever people are going to say, that goes beyond. They're stepping beyond where they should.
Pat Truman is with the Family Research Council. Pat, we've run out of time. We thank you so much. We'll continue this conversation at another time, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and stay there for continued coverage. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.